when the tape ended, we were talking about Paul Bagwell and Chamberlain, who was running for Congress, and you had indicated that you had helped them with a TV campaign.
Chuck wanted to know what he could pay me, and I finally said to him, look, if I were rich, you'd expect me to give you some money, wouldn't you? And he said, well, I don't have any money. I got a little talent, but that's helpful, fine. Consider it a donation. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I don't know, I got an idea. So anyway, the morning after the election, he called me up. We'd stopped at his house the night before late, and he said, Ted, I'd like you to go to Washington with me. And I said, what? He said, I just talked to President Hanna. And I said, oh my God. So I took a leave of absence from the university and went down to Washington and worked there for 8 months. And that was an education. Mm-hmm. That was at least equivalent about 2 years of graduate school, at least.
What year was that then?
That would have been 1957.
57, okay. Mm-hmm. So, and how long was Chamberlain in office?
Well, he was there for 18 years. And I won't say he fired me, but it was sort of by mutual agreement I would quit after 8 months. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it was a dog's life. I had to work 5.5, 6 days a week, sometimes more than that, sometimes evenings. I had so little time, I didn't get down to Mount Vernon until the last Saturday afternoon I was in Washington.
Oh, really?
I just took time to go sit. So I think if I had stayed in that job, I'd probably been dead in about a year, frankly. I remember Senator Griffin, later, he was a congressman at the time, said, asked me one day at lunch, said, how are you getting along? And I said, I've never worked so hard for anybody else in my life. I think Chuck appreciated me more after I left than he did while I was there, because he kept trying to get me to come back. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did work for him off and on all the rest of the time he was in Congress.
Mm-hmm. What were your main duties?
Oh, writing the occasional speech,
okay,
which I do at home at nights and weekends, mm-hmm, and things like that. That was the main thing. But in the summers, sometimes his wife and children were up here and even lonesome down there, so he had to come down and live with him while he was there. He also, in his last race, he kind of tricked me into coming back and working for him full time. I thought I was just going to be a help to his AA. He was a good friend of mine, I thought, but he had fired it. And I was suddenly it again, and I didn't know again any more than I'd known the first time about that job. Mm-hmm. So that was a real scramble. But then the last time I took a leave to work for him was during his fall term of 1974. Because I asked him what he was going to do with his official papers. He said, I'm going to have a big bonfire. I said, no, you can't do that. Well, then you have to come down and sort them out.
Yeah, you'd written a lot of them.
So he blackmailed me in a way to come down. So I took the fall term leave, and between the beginning of right after Labor Day until mid-December, he had 150 cartons of documents stored, mm-hmm, plus additionally, let's say, the filing cabinets in his office. I didn't get through many of those, got through the main storage ones, but I reduced everything. Well, then I came back here and worked the rest till the first of the year in his Lansing office, again going through all the files and ridding things out. Reduced the 150 cartons and all the rest of it to about 50 cartons, and labeled and filed and so on. So I always thought he should give them to our archives here. And I think he will someday, if he hasn't already made another distribution of it.
He's still living?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did he live in the Lansing area?
No. He didn't come back to Lansing. He joined a law firm about a block and a half from the White House.
Oh, okay.
And concentrated on making money, I think. And he became full partner of Webster and Chamberlain, the name of the firm, the last years he was in it. And of course, down in Washington, practicing law mainly means lobbying, you know, knowing who to talk to and what to say.
What is there anything that you learned from that experience in Washington?
Yes, sure did. It relieved me of a lot of illusions about lawmaking. It was I said that sometimes it's like having a ringside seat at a great big circus with a lot of clowns. But the what I say sounds kind of cynical if you first hear it. And when I say that the members of Congress are 98% concerned with re-election. But at the same time, that simply means they're trying to reflect the will and the wishes of their constituency, which is democracy in action. And there's an awful lot of compromise. If there's any one secret of our government, stability, it's compromise, adjustment. The loser never has to flee the country. And you realize that if the other party wins, it's not going to be a catastrophe, because there will be some accommodation of the minority's positions. And these when these committees hear witnesses and go over the legislation, they do their best not to just simply ironclad impose their will on the opposition. It's an accommodation so far as they can. And you can see this going on all the time in current legislation now on this, what prescription for the elders is an adjustment and so on. And that, I think, more than anything else, preserves the stability of our government. And I don't know that very many academics recognize this.
The ability to compromise.
to compromise, to adjust, to accommodate, to listen to the other side and take their views into account. When visitors come to Washington, I would often look up in the congressional record, see what committee hearings were going on that morning, and recommend they sit in there, because it's more interesting and informative than certainly listening to these canned speeches on the floor. Those are almost always for home consumption, for the record. Vandenberg only gave one speech in the Senate where it generally recognized that he changed people's views, and that was the confirmation of the nominee whose name I can't now recall for head of the Atomic Energy Commission. There was a lot of Republican opposition to him, but Vandenberg persuaded him to accept him. But that's the only speech.
Did you meet any of the other, you mentioned Bob Griffin, who was a congressman. Did you meet any of the other, the president?
Yes. The first summer, an invitation came to meet President Eisenhower. And so the last morning I was in Washington, I didn't point out to him I was leaving, about 8 o'clock, parked in the Oval, on the Oval Drive, and met him in the Oval Office with 50 or other congressional secretaries. In fact, I wrote a little article about it, because what's astonished me was how fluently and beautifully the man spoke. We were accustomed to listening to him in press conferences where he was often very hesitant and sometimes ungrammatical and so on, as a person normally is, but he talked to us in an understanding way about how difficult it is to be an assistant, an aide-de-camp, a secretary or whatever, and try to serve the boss, because he'd been in that role himself plenty. He knew what he was talking about.
serving MacArthur for a time.
He talked to us for 8 or 10 minutes, and just perfect presentation. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it up. A colleague, Mert Babcock, was editor of a Journal of Communication or something like that. I wrote it up for him. I can't remember too many other senators.
How about the other Michigan delegation?
Oh, yes.
Gerald Ford?
Almost all of them, Gerald Ford in his office. And there was some petition circulated for a nominee to the Supreme Court from Michigan. And I took it around to all the Michigan Republican congressmen to sign. And also, sometimes, especially in the summer, when just Chuck and I were by ourselves, and there'd be late legislation on the floor. About 5 o'clock or so, Chuck would unlock the safe and take out the booze. We would have a snort or two, and we'd go over to the Capitol when the vote was to come up, and there'd been other congressmen there who had also imbibed, and it was quite convivial. And I remember Chuck used to enjoy introducing me as his Ted Kennedy.
His Ted Kennedy.
There was a congressman from Ohio who was head of the administration committee and later on got in trouble, I think because of booze. Well, I hope you better not others, that's on me. That was fun. I saw Speaker Rayburn, of course. And one morning I was on over there on errand, and Speaker Martin came in the morning. Most interesting, though, one afternoon I had an errand to go over to the Senate office building. And I was going to the subway to go to the Senate office building, and here was Jack Kennedy. And this was in 1957, and of course everybody knew he was going to be the prize nominee. Mm-hmm. In 1960, and he was standing there, and some woman was yakking at him, a bunch of people, and I actually almost had to squeeze past him. Mm-hmm. There, that's the only time I remember seeing him. I did notice how poor his complexion was, very yellow. Mm-hmm. I've since read that he probably would not have lived through a second term from the
health.
I think Bright's disease, of that. Mm-hmm. So, but that was my only experience. Talked to Bobby Kennedy on the phone once. Mm-hmm. There are lots of names and faces.
What was it like coming back after leaving Washington?
Decompression. Decompression, yeah. That was funny. I sat at my office and said, gosh, what should I be doing? it took about a month before I could slow down and relax a bit.
Were you married at that time?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But your wife wasn't with you in Washington?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Wife and children, the whole, as they say, catastrophe.
We talk a little bit about some of the presidents that you had experience here at Michigan State. President Hanna obviously was the first one you had, or that hired you.
Yes,
what are your recollections about President Hanna?
We were concerned with civil rights in our course, and so one spring, he was chairman of the Civil Rights Commission. I went, my God. And I was teaching one of these large classes with 200 students in it. And I wrote to him, asked him if he would like to consider coming to my class and talking to them about this. After all, I thought it might do him some good to get in the classroom for one. And I didn't hear anything for about 3 weeks. And finally, I got an apologetic note from him. He said he was sorry. He was slow in replying. He kept hoping he could find time, but the schedule was just too full. He hoped I would give him a rain check. So the next winter term, when we were spending, my class was giving a little attention to the Civil War and that era, I issued the rain check, and he accepted. And he came over, it was in Wilson Hall, a big auditorium there, and I told the students he was coming and they could bring a friend if they wanted to. There was room available. So when the time came to introduce him, I said, I don't know if I should say this or not, but we believe always in this course in facing the truth. Dr. Han and I have been colleagues now for more than 20 years, and during this time, I've had 2 promotions and he hasn't had any. I guess some of us have it and some of us don't. So that kind of relaxed everything there.
So he responded well to that.
Yeah. And I mentioned that I had been, for my sins, I'd been in Washington in 1957. And he looked up, oh, I could see, oh, you're the one. And told him about, I was listening to the debates on the Civil Rights Bill. I said, there are many, many eloquent speeches on the subject. Adam Clayton Powell gave a powerful speech in support of the bill, but the House passed it anyway. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of weeks later, I went over to the Senate and was there when Nixon, the Vice President, made the parliamentary ruling that let the Senate take the bill up instead of consigning it to the committee, judicial committee, where mm-hmm. it would never see the light of day.
Be buried, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he talked to the class, and it was very good. A lot of interesting things, a lot of lively questions came up, and so it was a good session. I think Hannah was a wonderful administrator, and I think he would have done just as well as head of General Motors as of Michigan State, maybe even better. He had one glaring fault. I mentioned when I first came here, I was kind of shocked at the attitude of the students not being very aggressive or businesslike.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he ever understood what a dead weight a few dull students could be in a classroom, especially with a small class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
His view always was to keep every student here as long as they could, possibly be kept. And so actually, I jokingly once, my brother asked me, he said, how many students are there at Michigan State? And I said, about half. It was kind of cynical exaggeration. But I would say there were about 25% of our students that should never have been admitted or should have been ousted, better yet, mm-hmm. ousted.
Mm-hmm.
I remember students telling me that they used to run a special train from Champaign, Illinois, up to Chicago at the end of the first semester for the students who had flunked out.
Oh, really?
And the same thing is true at Wisconsin. They'd flunk you out at Wisconsin on midterm grades.
Mm.
Anyone who got a high school degree could be admitted. So they'd admit them, but they'd flunk them out wholesale. Mm-hmm. And now that was pre-war, of course. Whether it's still that severe or not, I don't know. But that's mostly what Michigan State needed, is just to... get rid of the dullards that are, and the kids of Playboy, the rioters, that sort of nonsense,
mm-hmm.
and they suffer for that. The later, I don't know, in the 19, or about 61 or so, I worked for a while as an assistant to Newt Winburn, who was the student affairs office for the University College. And we had a peculiar program. Any student could stay here for almost 2 years. They had a minimum requirement, and if you didn't meet that, then you'd get some kind of a probation. Then they'd get final warning 1 and final warning 2. And mm-hmm. finally, of course, if you flunked every course, you'd be out. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you could stick around here for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it seems to me this program instead of letting them stay for 2 years and chopping their heads off, which you almost had to do because if they didn't have a pretty good average, they wouldn't be transferred from the university college to the degree-granting college. So every student that came in was in university college and for 2 years. And so we set up a step scale. At a certain level of credits, you had to have a certain average. And by the end of 2 years, you had to be at the 2 point. And so if they got below that step scale, they'd find it out much sooner. And they could either do something about it or they'd be ousted. And Hannah learned about this in due course, sometime later. And they changed it. Do away with this double hurdle of having to have a 2 point average, you know, in 2 years, and then the same thing at the end of 4 years. So they revised the scale to make it a 4-year scale. Of course, the colleges that really count, the engineering and the others, it still would demand a good record at the end, even at the end of 1 year. So, in other words, the one thing we had going for us to tighten up the academic standards here, he changed that. And I think that was a bad mistake. And I think the problem was he'd never taught college himself or school. So he didn't realize the heavy dulling effect of poor students in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. And his emphasis was on expansion in terms of the university and number.
Well, he had the belief that, you know, any student would benefit from being on the campus. Which is perhaps true. I don't know, it's universally true. I heard a story about him once that they had the admissions office had an arrangement whereby with some students who were borderline on admission, they would have them come to the campus and be given special tests and be interviewed. And then on the basis of those results, they would be admitted or not. And Hannah said, about how many are admitted? And, well, maybe 5 out of 100. He says, I want you one to admit all 100. And we'll see how they do. And they admitted the 100, and 97 of them didn't make it. But Hannah says, see, 3, I told you were keeping some students out. The story may be apocryphal, but I don't think so. I don't remember who told it to. It was someone who would have known.
In the 1960s, student activism rising, the changes that occurred on campus, what's your reflection on that?
Well, it was a pretty unhappy time. One recollection is very vivid in my memory. I was teaching a class, an afternoon class, and Walter Adams and his pal LaRue, Professor LaRue, were leading. Now these guys are both veterans of wars. Mm-hmm. They were leading in perhaps 100 or so students down Farm Lane, and then they turned on Shaw Lane and headed westward. And they were chanting. And my class is over in the west side of a building. When they were over on the south campus, the chanting was loud through, and I stopped. I said to my students, you know, this brings back a memory to me. It sounds almost exactly like the radio broadcasts I heard in the middle 1930s by William L. Shirer from Berlin. Only then they were chanting, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. I said, I hated it then and I hate this now. Because this is the antithesis of what a university should be doing, which is weighing and winnowing. Mm-hmm. I was just outraged at the holiday, although I guess President Wharton had to call it after the Kent State killings. But it was, as far as I could see, what we were dealing with was a generation of brats. They never really had to do anything they didn't want to do. You could hear their parents trying, yeah, come on, honey, don't you want to go home now? No! That sort of thing. And the schools had been pushing them along and passing them and never disciplining them. The paddle had disappeared from the class, from the schoolroom. And they came to college where there should be some discipline, and that had been brushed aside too. But the U.S. Army was a discipline they were afraid of, and especially of the chances were of going to Vietnam, getting hurt or killed. Well, I can't blame them too much for not wanting to sacrifice their life. But it was just a reaction to me. It was a reaction of a spoiled generation. I think had the same kind of thing happened in our day, we probably would have objected, but it would have been a different kind of objection. Mm-hmm. It would have been public forums, speeches, letters, that sort of thing.
Were you surprised when President Hanna left, when he resigned?
Yes, I was rather surprised. In fact, that may have been while I was on leave, or shortly after, or right after I got back, 1969, spring term, I took a leave of absence and made my first trip to Europe. And the what surprised me, I took it because I'd just never been there. I wanted to go. I felt it's almost part of a person's education. What has surprised me is how much use I made of that experience after I got back to teaching here, even though it's an American thought and language course. Constant references to it. But anyway, I think that happened either a while on the way or shortly after I got back. And very, very sad. I was surprised because he had a long and honorable career. And I couldn't see that things were any different in 69 than they had been in 59, really.
Were you involved in any of the presidential searches?
No, not directly.
Okay.
I was acquainted with a member of the committee who was, and in a strictly personal arena, nothing on the campus. All the things that appeared in the press were not entirely true. There were at least two applicants for the job who desperately wanted it, tried the best to persuade the committee to recommend them. One was Walter Adams, and the other was Menon Williams. And I have that directly from a member of the committee, just to make the recommendation. And both publicly demurred. But the thing got tangled up. The Republicans, I think, were in the minority. They had only two members of the Board of Trustees. And then one of the members, the local dentist, former football player, a great person whose name I can't
Blanche Martin.
Blanche Martin. Of course, when he said Wharton came along, that's the one he wanted. And the Republicans saw Wharton as the best choice of those being considered. So it was kind of a stalemate. I guess it was four of them wanted Wharton, but they needed a fifth vote. And finally, a member of the UAW had put on the board, it was an official of their union. He voted for Wharton. The union wanted Menon Williams. And for doing that, violating that, he promptly got fired from his union job. And for a year or two, he worked up in Minneapolis. So it was strictly a political fight. And I suppose it would make a whole world of difference which one had been picked. A president or any other administrative officer can do harm, but they have a limited capacity to do good.
Mm-hmm.
If they do good, it's gradual and over a period of time.
What was your assessment of the Wharton presidency?
Well, I think Walter Adams put his finger on it. He said it was almost like not having a president.
Mm-hmm.
That and the fact that our building didn't get cleaned very regularly for a while, there was a pinch of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really depressing to come in and find the floors of the stairs, the hallway just filthy dirty.
Mm-hmm.
You get cleaned maybe once a week in the winter term when the kids are tracking the snow and grime. So there is one other thing though. I made my only contribution to Michigan State University while Wharton was president. I was teaching a class that ran from 11:30 to 12:20, over here. And at 12, first day of the month, at 12 o'clock, damn siren blasted away. And it went on for about a minute, then a brief pause, then it went on for another minute. And this has happened to me many times over the years, but this time I was just furious. So angry. I went to my office and I wrote a letter to the president and said, you know, I think it's stupid that these things have to be, sirens have to be tested every month. We went through World War II and only had them tested once or twice a year. But... It-